WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In the early 70s, Bonnie Raitt seemed like an unlikely person to popularize the blues. She was white, from a prosperous family, she'd been to Radcliffe College, and her father is John Raitt, who starred on Broadway in The Pajama Game and Carousel. But Bonnie Raitt fell in love with the blues and learned to play slide guitar. She befriended blues singers Fred McDowell and Sippy Wallace and introduced their songs to her audiences. Raitt's repertoire extends beyond the blues. She sings material by contemporary singer-songwriters like Jackson Browne and John Hiatt. She writes her own songs and does rock and roll and ballads. I think it's fair to say her first two albums, Bonnie Raitt and Give It Up, were staples in the record collections of most college students in the early 70s. Even during periods when her record sales have been down, she's maintained an audience devoted to her singing and playing. Bonnie Raitt has a new album scheduled for release in a couple of weeks. It's called Nick of Time, and it's produced by Don Was of the band Was Not Was. From that album, this is Too Soon to Tell.
So now there's somebody new. These dreams I've been dreaming have all
Bonnie Raitt, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on the show. I love it.
Okay. I want to ask you a little bit about the new record. I sense this freedom on the record to sing in different styles, do different kinds of songs, blues, ballads, rock songs. Is that something that you always have on records?
It was especially my trademark in the beginning when I was first signed to Warner Brothers back in 71. My first three albums were pretty eclectic that way, and that's the way my musical taste runs, and I think my fans also. There was some criticism at some point when the records didn't sell that possibly that was because it was too eclectic and people couldn't categorize me, which, it's just the way it is. So I stayed with my loyal following and did what I wanted. People are always trying to figure out which direction I'm going to go in next, and I basically just have always played the same mix of rhythm and blues and country and folk and rock and jazz, and I wish radio was open to playing all those different categories also. And the reason this one is like that is because not only am I on a new label who supports that idea of encouraging me to do what I do best, which is probably eclectic stuff, but also the climate of radio, I think, has changed and is coming back around to appreciating roots music and different types of ethnic music. And let's hope there'll be a resurgence of blues and rhythm and blues.
Do you think your voice has changed since the early 70s when you started recording?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, I listen to that stuff and I can barely take it because I always wanted to sound like Etta James. And to me, even though I love Joni Mitchell, I was leaning too much towards that high, sweet kind of sound. And I really wanted to sound like I was, you know, right about like what I am now, which is a broad that's been playing music for 20 years. It's been playing clubs and concerts. And my voice has kind of gotten richer and thicker and, a little huskier. And that's more the way I like to hear it. But I still don't spend a lot of time listening to myself, I'll tell you that.
Did you do things when you were younger to try to deepen your voice?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, just being a rock and roll and blues singer for all these years, you live a lifestyle that's got a lot of late nights and a lot of partying and all that. So I imagine that contributed to it. And I think just a certain amount of maturity. And I like to think that I play and sing better than I did when I was 21. And hopefully when I'm 60, I'll be playing better than now.
You've said that you once took singing lessons to try to protect your voice, but you stopped because you ended up sounding like Vicky Carr. I thought that was really funny.
Well, no, nothing against Vicky Carr either. I just, a lot of those singing teachers want you to sing more legitimate, and you end up doing scales that really are more suited for operatic or Broadway singing. And I kind of left it alone, although I think now as I get older, I'm going to be vocalizing more, even though my band laughs at me when I do it. But just to keep the muscles in the throat from being strained, and so you can sing through a cold. But most of all, I just recommend being healthy. And I, you know, the things that would wear me down and dissipate me, I don't do anymore. So in general, I'm in a pretty good rejuvenated state, singing wise and physically.
Your father, John Raitt, had a flourishing Broadway career, best known for his starring role in Pajama Game. Were you self-conscious when you started singing blues that your father was a Broadway star, since the two kinds of music are considered really opposite by a lot of people?
Yeah, it was pretty ironic, but I mean, our generation was growing up with folk music and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and I became a complete blues freak the minute I heard that kind of music, as I'm a big fan of Motown and Stax Vold and soul music. I just think it was a generational thing more than anything, and I certainly don't have my dad's incredible range of and volume of voice. I mean, he still continues to sing all the time. I just saw him in South Pacific last weekend, and you know, Carousel is another show that he created the starring role in, and continues to sing better than ever, and is a constant inspiration to me. But in terms of musical styles, he thought it was kind of odd that his, you know, 16, 17 year old daughter was singing these kind of double entendre Sippy Wallace songs. So I think he's real proud of me that I've managed to stay in this as long as I have, and I'm proud of him for doing the same.
My guest is singer and guitarist Bonnie Raitt, and she has a new album called Nick of Time that will be out in just a few weeks. I want to play the title song from this album, which is a song that you wrote. And before we hear it, I'd like to ask you if there was something in your life that led to the lyric.
Yeah, I was really inspired to write something that, you know, as an interpreter of other people's material, a lot of times I'm singing whatever I choose to sing is something that I really believe in also, and something I'm going through at the same time. Usually Jackson Browne's a good friend, and I like to sing his songs for that reason. And this particular tune, I just had a bunch of things on my mind that I hadn't heard anybody else say, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to have to get down and write another song, because it doesn't come easily for me. But a friend of mine was, in fact, like the first verse says, going through this situation, having to decide, as a lot of women our age, or my age anyway, are trying to decide whether to have children or whether their career still takes some more time to work on, or whether the two are in conflict with each other. And in this case, the man in her life isn't ready to have children, and she's got to decide because she's almost 40. So the poignancy of that situation was not lost on me, and that's basically, on a long drive in my car one time, it just came to me. And the other verse is about my parents getting older and consequently us looking at each other getting older, and just about the choices you make at this point in your life.
Well, this is the song Nick of Time. It's the title track from Bonnie Raitt's new album, and she's featured on vocals and piano. Nick of Time from Bonnie Raitt's new album of the same name, and that album will actually be coming out in just a few weeks. Did you sing any Broadway songs when you were young?
I sure did. I'm a huge fan of Carousel in Oklahoma from hearing my dad do them for so many years, and Pajama Game also. And I did some high school productions of things like Plain and Fancy, which was a kind of an obscure show. And I know all the words to most of the musicals I grew up listening to in my house.
You never sing that on your records, right?
I never sing. Well, I sing. My dad comes and sings Oklahoma and really usually steals my show a lot of times when he comes out with the band. And he and I sing duets together sometimes. And we sang Blowing Away together once, which was really lovely. And I back him up on guitar. And he's just such an overwhelming singer that I like to shut up or sing harmony.
How did you find the blues and rhythm and blues?
I basically loved soul music. And I also loved folk music. And when I heard the blues at Newport in 63, when I was 13, which is an album on Vanguard, with Mississippi John Hurt and Brownie McGee, Sonny Terry, Dave Van Ronk, John Lee Hooker, John Hammond, that was the first time I'd actually heard blues. And I just went crazy. I had already been playing Joan Baez songs and Peter, Paul, and Mary songs, as was the whole country at the time in the early 60s, you know, going to peace marches and civil rights rallies and singing Times They Are Changing and all that. And when I heard this other offshoot coming out of the Newport Folk Festival, which was blues, I then tried to get my hands on every record I could and just sat in my room and learned everything I could until I never really planned to do this for a living. And when I was in college back in the East, it became a kind of an oddity that I was playing Robert Johnson songs. So the next thing I knew, I was getting gigs in little clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fell into it because it was an oddity for a young white girl to be playing that kind of music.
Well, exactly. And I was wondering if you ever had an authenticity crisis, you know, as a white middle class woman who's the daughter of a Broadway star. Did people ever say, "How, you know, do you have the right to sing the blues?"
Hey, I ask the guys I go out with. you know, blues doesn't, you don't have to be white or poor or colored or black or green or whatever, you know. It's just this, that stuff is a constant. I think that blues music needs to be appreciated in its original form, and I had the honor of working with a lot of the great Delta players and Chicago players who did not get recognized while they were alive, and even now the ones that are still touring should be much bigger stars than they are. So I think there's no problem with people doing each other's music as long as you give credit where credit is due. And basically, whether I'm authentic enough is up to somebody that wants to decide whether they spend money to come and see me. I've been a big fan of this music for a long time, and I play it because I really just have to play it. I love it, and I never asked anybody to like my version of it, and then when they did, I've been lucky enough to get away with it for 20 years.
When you first started singing blues and traveling on the road performing, did you try on the part of blues mama, and were there certain affectations you took on when you were younger that you later gave up, realizing that you didn't have to do that?
Well, I wouldn't call them affectations. I mean, I romanticized rock and roll and blues as a lifestyle, as did many of the other people that went into music, just the way book writers feel like they have to be tortured souls, and they also have a tendency to drink too much, and so do rock and rollers who party too much. And I chose this lifestyle because I really loved it, and I had a great time in my 20s and early 30s staying up late and partying with my friends, and because I got my work done. I mean, it wasn't excessive. It wasn't really driving me. And then recently, since I'm 39 now, in the last couple of years, I decided I want to feel better and look better and sing better. And that kind of lifestyle can be kind of debilitating spiritually and emotionally, as well as physically and creatively. So I'm happily sober and healthy, and doesn't seem to affect anything other than the fact that I feel great. You know, I mean, it doesn't change my music. I didn't become a Mooney. I didn't stop being funky or anything. It's just one of the things that my generation of rock and rollers and folk singers and blues singers has learned from losing a lot of our friends from this lifestyle is that at 36 or 37, you've got to cool it. So it's something I'm real happy to have gotten out of my system, and I don't miss it, and I think it's going to allow me to be able to do this for another 30 or 40 years, I hope.
Was there a specific turning point where you realized you wanted to change, you wanted to stop drinking and stop partying that late?
Yeah, you know, you take stock of what you look like and what you feel like one day and just look in the mirror and go, come on, this isn't working, you know. And I also noticed a lot of my friends stopping, and they seemed to be much more at peace and healthier, and they looked better, and they seemed to be having more successful personal lives, and they're writing great songs. And again, I was always afraid that I would turn into some kind of fruity born again kind of a, you know, prissy type of person, and the two personalities wouldn't be able to get together in my head. But it turned out it wasn't the case, and if anything, I feel more frisky than I did when I was 20, you know.
When I first saw you in the early 70s performing, it struck me that the men and the women in the audience were relating to you really differently, that everybody in the audience was there because they really liked your singing and guitar playing. But the men had all these kind of romantic fantasies about you, whereas the women...
That's a good one. Pardon me while I laugh.
Okay. Whereas the women really saw you as important because there was a certain strength that you seemed to have. You played guitar, bottleneck guitar, you know, slide guitar as well as a regular guitar. And it was, I think, very exciting to see a woman on stage playing an instrument really well and singing and just having this just strong sense about her. Did you feel that from audiences, that you meant different things to the men and the women?
Yeah, I do feel that, and I get a lot of letters from people, and I've been told from, I'm really proud to be a role model in some ways for women that are, you know, feeling like they want to be independent and strong and yet keep their vulnerable side and not be too butch or, you know, it's just, it's an interesting time to be a woman and to try to come out of your cultural shell as we did, and the feminist movement was growing up the same time we were, and I think that the women that have followed me all these years, and, you know, I'm sure there's younger ones, too. There's, like, daughters of people that were fans of mine from the beginning that are coming up saying that they really derive some inspiration from the songs that I do and that they play guitar because their mom used to play their records for me. And I know Winona Judd was real influenced. I'm very proud to have been a role model, and I'm certainly not perfect or a saint, but it's one of the things that means a lot more to me to have lived my life as, you know, politically trying to do the things that I believe in and musically trying to champion the music that I believe in. And I really couldn't care less about commercial success in relation to having the respect of my peers and my fans whose hearts I've touched with what I'm trying to do. And that's all I really cared about. So in that sense, I've had a real successful run.
You've sung a lot of double entendre type of blues songs over the years. And when you started singing them in the early 70s, it was just the time when a lot of women were really discovering feminism and being very firm in the idea that they didn't want to be sexual objects in men's eyes. And I wonder what it was like for you to be discovering these blues songs and sexual double entendre songs at the same time that you were probably also discovering feminism.
Well, if you'll notice, the songs that I do, especially the Sippy Wallace tunes, they are precisely about being, you know, about being sexual and expecting sexual parity and not be, you know, justice is what it's about. You know, you can sing about justice in Central America and you can sing about justice in a relationship. And most of the songs I sing are, if you don't treat me right, get the hell out of here, you know, or you can make me do what you want to do, but you better know how. And you know, I got a lot of flack for singing Sippy's Women Be Wise song, which has a lyric, "Women be wise, keep your mouth shut, don't advertise your man." Some women these days, they ain't no good, you know, and basically the tone of the song is that, you know, if your old man knows how to do something great to you, don't brag about him because somebody else is going to check him out. And at the time, there was all this talk of sisterhood and nobody should ever, you know, try to steal each other's man. And the fact is that that's been going on since the beginning of time, whether we like it or not. And it was, you know, done with a sense of humor. And it's a little wink and a little nudge and a sexual battleground or the playground, however you choose to look at it, is something that should be, you should sing about from all the different angles of it. And I caught a little flack from gay women and feminist women in the beginning, but it's all contained in my estimation of myself is that I'm not going to take any undue grief from anybody, especially not anymore. And, you know, you try to be as playful and as strong at the same time. And all these songs that I sing, if you take them as a whole, they project a pretty strong yet vulnerable impression. And that's the one I think is the one I feel, and I think a lot of women do also. But it was awkward at the time. But I think the double entendre part of it is just a celebration of sexuality. Nothing wrong with that.
I want to play one of those double entendre songs, and this is from the second album that you made, from Give It Up. And this is a Sippy Wallace song called Gotta Know How.
Mm-hmm.
That's Bonnie Raitt, her second album from, what is it, around 1973?
72.
72, well,
it takes,
yeah.
Takes me back. I have to sit here with a big grin on my face, listening to that and remembering all the things that were going on at the time. That's a great thing about being able to do this over a long period of time, is each record is like a time capsule for me of the musicians I played with and what was going on.
The song that we just heard was written by Sippy Wallace, who you had befriended, and you sang a lot of her songs and recorded a record with her, and you were really responsible for bringing her into prominence again. Was she something of a role model for you? Was it important for you to find a woman who had sung the blues?
Yeah, Sippy's songs were different than some of the other classic blues songs of the period, because she was not a victim. I mean, her songs were really strong, and she was, you know, asking the guys that she was singing to treat her right. And it basically wasn't, you know, beat me up and I'll still love you kind of a thing. And I just liked her attitude, and I liked her humor, and I liked her sassiness, and had no idea she was still alive when I recorded those songs. And when I found out she was alive and living in Detroit, when they asked me to play the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival back in 72, I asked her to come out and meet me, and asked her if she would sing a song. And initially she only would do a gospel song, she said, because like a lot of older blues people, there's a schism between singing the blues, which is the devil's music in some people's minds, and then singing gospel music as you get older and you're trying to make peace with God for all the stuff you did when you were younger. And she got in the trailer and was just sort of, I started singing Women Be Wise, and my clarinetist was playing, and she started rocking back and forth and said, well, maybe I could just do one or two, you know. So it ended up being the beginning of a new career for her, and a very close friendship until she passed away a couple of years ago. I miss her a lot and sing songs and feel her presence all the time when I sing her stuff.
Mm-hmm. Where do you find songs now? Some of them you write yourself, some of them are older songs, but a lot of them are from your contemporaries. Are most of the songwriters whose songs you sing friends of yours?
Yeah, I listen to, the work part of what I do, aside from packing and unpacking and changing cities every day, is listening to hundreds of tapes, unsolicited or solicited, and calling up lots of people and finding out who's got what songs. And I basically find somebody like Jerry Williams, whose songs I've recorded, two on this album and several on the other albums I've done. A woman from San Francisco named Bonnie Hayes, who's got two excellent albums out that are as hard to find as mine are. And I love her writing, and I tend to stick with people. Once I find them, I tend to find a certain compatibility, and musically and lyrically, and then I like to stay with them for a while. That's why I've done quite a few Eric Cass songs and Jackson Browne songs, and it's fun. I'm basically an interpreter, you know. I am a big fan of other people's music, and when I find a song that really touches me, I usually find myself sitting down at the piano or the guitar and learning it in my key and putting my slant on it, and then if it really fits right and I think I can add something new to it, I record it.
You sing a lot of ballads, and it really always sounds like you're putting your heart and soul into it when you're singing a song about heartbreak. And I guess I'm wondering if it's exhausting to put yourself through that. You seem to really get emotionally involved in those songs.
Yeah, I tell you, if I did ballads all the time, I would probably slip my wrist at the end of the show. But that's why, that's why you mix it up a little bit. I don't think the audience wants to hear too many sad songs in a row. I've accidentally put a string of things together that have made me end up not being able to go on for a minute and have to take a little break. There's certain songs like River of Tears, which is an Eric Cass song from the Green Light album that I sang with Richard Manuel from the band, and at night when I sing it, I dedicate it to Lowell George and Paul Butterfield and Richard and Jesse Ed Davis and Roy Buchanan and a bunch of friends of mine that I've lost from rock and roll living. And sometimes if I sing that and stay too long at the fair and song about the Midway in a row, I'm done myself in. So that's when it's time to reel out something funky, you know, kick it up a little bit. And then, you know, I think that's why people play music. They get inspired both ways, mm-hmm. to go on and to have their heart broken again.
Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and we only have about a minute left. So I just want to ask you about Being on the Road. A song that you wrote for your new album is called The Road's My Middle Name. Is it going to be hard for you staying on the road, having given up some of the alcohol and late nights and things that you were talking about before? It seems that the road leads to that so easily.
Well, I've been doing it for a couple of years now, and it's, if anything, it just makes it really fun for me to be able to have a bunch of extra hours and do different things. Like I said, I enjoyed it while I was doing it. I'm enjoying not doing it. I had enough. I'm looking forward to doing this like Sippy. I mean, Sippy was 88 when she died. My dad's 72 now and going strong. And one of the great things about not being a sex goddess is that people listen to what I sing and not what I look, and don't care so much what I look like. So I guess I'll be able to, more gracefully than others, being an instrumentalist and an interpreter of other people's material and blues and jazz, being accepted when you're 66 years old or whatever, a little bit more easily than rock and roll. It'll be interesting to see how many of us survive, and it isn't difficult at all. It's just, it feels great. I really love my job, and I feel very lucky to be able to keep doing it.
Bonnie Raitt, thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My pleasure.